One can choose one's own life.
Okay, suppose I were to accept your suggestion. I refrain from rebuking, stop inquiring as to the causes of their behavior, and ask the students, "What should you do from now on?" What would be the result? I don't even have to think about it. All I'd get would be lip service statements of self-reflection like, "I won't do it again," or "I'll do things correctly from now on."
Whenever words of self-reflection are forced, nothing will come of it. That is to be expected. People are often made to write essays of apology or self-reflection, but their writings are written only with the goal of being forgiven and never lead to true self-reflection. It is unlikely that they become anything more than objects of self-satisfaction for the person who had them written. But be that as it may, what I would question here is that person's way of living.
Way of living?
To paraphrase Kant, whose discussion of self-reliance is pertinent here, man's juvenile condition is not due to lack of reason. It is that he has neither the resolution nor the courage to use his reason without direction from another. That is to say, man is responsible for being stuck in his own juvenile condition.
Juvenile condition?
Yes, it is the condition of not attaining true self-reliance. One may understand Kant's use of the word reason as referring to ability in general and to include everything from intelligence to sensibility.
It is not that we lack ability, but that we don't have enough courage to use our ability. And that's why we can't get past our juvenile condition?
That's right. And then Kant declares, have courage to use your own reason.
Huh. That's just like Adler, isn't it?
Now, why do people try to keep themselves in a juvenile condition? Or to put it more plainly, why do people reject self-reliance? What is your view?
Is it because of cowardice?
It may be, in some cases. But consider Kant's words once more. It is easier to live according to the direction from another. One does not have to think about difficult things, and one does not have to take responsibility for failure. All one has to do is swear a certain allegiance, and someone will take care of all of one's troublesome tasks, from children in families and schools, to members of society working at companies and government offices, to clients who come for counseling. Isn't it so?
Well, I guess so.
Moreover, in order to keep children in a juvenile condition, the adults around them use every conceivable means to indoctrinate children regarding the dangers, risks, and scariness of self-reliance.
What for?
To keep them under their control.
Why would they do such a thing?
This is probably something you should think over carefully and ask yourself, because without noticing it, you too are getting in the way of your student's self-reliance.
I am.
Yes, make no mistake about this. No matter what they do, parents and then educators engage in excessive meddling with and nurturing of their children. As a result, they end up raising children who cannot decide anything on their own and who need constant direction from others. They raise people who will always have children's minds and who will be incapable of doing things without direction from others, even if they are adults in terms of age. This is not self-reliance in any shape or form.
No way. At the very least, I'm hoping that my students will become self-reliant. Why would I be actually hindering them?
Don't you see? You are afraid of letting them become self-reliant.
What? How is that?
If your students become self-reliant and they assume a standpoint on equal footing with you, your authority will collapse. Right now, you are erecting a vertical relationship with your students, and you are afraid of that relationship collapsing. This is a fear held subconsciously not only by educators, but by many parents as well.
No, I don't.
One other thing. When children fail, and especially when they disturb others, it is only natural that you too are held responsible. It is your responsibility as an educator and as a supervisor, and if you are a parent, it is your responsibility as a parent. Do you see?
Yes, of course.
What can one do to evade that responsibility? The answer is easy. Control the children. One allows the children to take only those paths that are safe and free from harm without permitting any adventure. One keeps them under one's control as much as possible. One does not do this out of concern for the children. It is all for one's own self-protection.
Because one doesn't want to be held responsible for the children's failures?
That is how it goes, and this is precisely why people in positions in education and leaders charged with the management of organizations must always uphold the objective of self-reliance.
So as not to get carried away with self-protection.
It is the same with counseling. When we give counseling, we are always very careful not to put the client in a position of dependence and irresponsibility. Counseling that allows the client to say, "Thanks to you, I'm all better," is not solving anything. Because, put another way, what they are really saying is, "I can't do anything by myself."
They are dependent on their counselors?
Right. And the same thing can be said about you, that is to say about educators. Educators who let their students say things like, "Thanks to you, I was able to graduate," or "Thanks to you, I was able to pass my exams," are failing to provide education in the truest sense of the word. It is necessary to have the students gain the awareness that they can accomplish things on their own power.
But
an educator is a lonely creature. One's students all finish school on their own power, and one isn't praised or appreciated for one's efforts. One does it without receiving gratitude.
So one accepts that loneliness?
Yes. Rather than expecting gratitude from the students, one has the feeling that one has been able to contribute to the grand objective of self-reliance. One finds happiness in the feeling of contribution. That is the only way.
The feeling of contribution.
As I surely said to you 3 years ago, the essence of happiness is the feeling of contribution. If you are hoping to receive gratitude from your students, if it's thanks to you that are words you are waiting to hear, then please know that, in effect, you are standing in the way of their self-reliance.
Then, concretely speaking, in what way can one provide an education that does not put children in positions of dependence or irresponsibility? In what way can one aid in self-reliance? You have to show me concrete examples, not concepts. Otherwise, I can't accept this.
All right. Suppose a child asks, "Can I go and play at my friend's place?" There are parents who will grant permission. "Of course you can," and then set the condition. "Once you've done your homework." And there are others who will simply prohibit their children from going out to play. Both are forms of conduct that put the child in a position of dependence and irresponsibility. Instead, teach the child by saying, "That is something you can decide on your own." Teach that one's own life and one's everyday actions are things that one determines oneself. And if deciding things requires certain ingredients, knowledge and experience, for example, then provide them. That is how educators should be.
Decide on your own. Do they have that capacity for judgment?
If you doubt that, then you do not have enough respect for them yet. If you have real respect for them, then you should be able to let them decide everything on their own.
And what if that leads to an irreparable mistake?
It is no different with paths that are chosen for them by their parents and by teachers. How can you say for sure that their choices will always end in failure, while the paths they are directed to will not?
But that's...
When children make mistakes, your responsibility is called into question. But that is not the kind of responsibility that one would stake one's life on. Responsibility, in the true sense of the word, is something that only that person can make themselves take. This is what has led to the idea of separation of tasks. The idea, in other words, that says, who ultimately is going to receive the end result brought about by the choice that is made. You, who are not in the position of receiving the final responsibility, must not intervene in others' tasks.
You're saying to just leave the children alone?
No, I am not. I am saying to have regard for the children's decisions and to help them in those decisions, and to convey to them that you are always ready to help them and to watch over them at a distance from which you can help them that is not too close. Should those decisions end in failure, the children will learn from you the truth that one can choose one's own life.
One can choose one's own life.
One can choose one's own life. This is the main overarching theme of our discussion today, so please be sure to remember it well. Yes, write it down in your notebook. Now, let's take a little break at this juncture. Please reflect on the attitude you have taken when approaching your students.
No way. I don't need a break or anything. Let's keep at it.
The dialogue from this point onward is going to require even more concentration, which requires taking proper breaks. I'm going to make some coffee, so now would be a good time for you to calm down a bit and sort things out.
Part 3. From the principle of competition to the principle of cooperation. The objective of education is self-reliance, and the educator is a counselor. At the beginning, the youth had taken these two terms by their conventional definitions and had not given them much thought. As the discussion progressed, however, his doubts with regard to his own educational policy had grown rapidly.
Is my law and order maintaining approach all wrong? Have I been fearing and standing in the way of my students' self-reliance? No, there's no way. I've been supporting their self-reliance all along, there's no doubt about it.
The philosopher sitting before him silently stroked his fountain pen.
Look at him, so aloof and triumphant.
The youth wet his rough lips with coffee and began to speak in a tormented voice. Negate praise-based development.
The educator must not be a judge, but rather a counselor who is always there for the child. And rebuking is a form of conduct that only reveals one's own immaturity and gives rise to contempt. The final objective of education is self-reliance, and one must not stand in the way of that path. All right, for the time being, I will accept that one must not rebuke, but only if you acknowledge my next question.
Which is?
We often discuss with colleagues and parents whether rebuke-based child rearing and praise-based child rearing are right or wrong. It goes without saying that rebuke-based child rearing is unpopular. This is likely due to the trends of our time, and there are many people who reject it from a moral standpoint. I agree with this standpoint myself, for the most part, as I have no desire to rebuke. On the other hand, praise-based child rearing has an enormous following. Practically no one renounces it directly.
I suppose that is so.
However, Adler goes as far as to renounce praise. 3 years ago, when I asked why, your answer went something like this. Praising is the passing of judgment by a person of ability on a person of no ability, and its goal is manipulation, and therefore one must not praise.
Yes, I did say that.
I believed that, and I practiced no praising education faithfully. However, this only lasted until my mistake was noticed by a certain student.
By a certain student?
It was several months ago. One of the worst problem children in our school handed in a book report he had written. It was an open assignment for summer vacation, and to my astonishment, he had gone and read Camus' The Stranger. Moreover, I was astonished by what he had written about the book. It was quite a wonderful essay, brimming with the fresh sensibilities that only a sensitive boy going through puberty could possess. Once I had read it, before I knew what I was doing, I praised him. I said, "Hey, Great work. I had no idea you could write such a fine composition. It's changed my opinion of you.
I see.
The moment I said it, I knew I'd messed up. Those words, "it's changed my opinion of you," in particular, were filled with that judgment from above that Adler talks about. I guess you could say that I was belittling him.
Yes, because those words would not have come out otherwise.
Regardless, I had actually praised him. Moreover, I had done so with words of undisguised judgment. Now, what kind of expression do you think this problem child had on his face upon hearing those words? Was he repelled? Ah, if only I could show you the face he made. He gave me such a smile, the likes of which he had never shown me before. The smile of a truly pure and innocent boy. It felt just like my head had been in a fog, and now it was clearing before my eyes. And I said to myself, what is up with Adler anyway? Thanks to getting caught up in this quackery, I've been giving an education that could only take away such a smile, such joyfulness. What kind of education is that?
So, then you started praising.
Yes, of course. I praised without hesitation, not only him, but the other students too. And when I did that, they seemed pleased with it, and they made progress with their schoolwork. The more I praised them, the more drive they exhibited. I could only think of it as a positive cycle of growth.
And you were getting excellent results.
Yes, but I wasn't just praising all of them indiscriminately, of course. I praised them according to their level of effort and success. Because if I did otherwise, the compliments would just be lies. That problem child who wrote the book report is a total bookworm now. He just reads tons of books and writes essays on them. It's really wonderful, isn't it? How books can open up one's world. I imagine that pretty soon the library room at school won't satisfy him anymore, and he'll start going to the university library, the library where I used to work.
If he does, that would be quite impressive.
I know. I'm sure you'll dismiss this. You'll say that it's a demand for admiration and the first stage of problem behavior, but, you know, the reality is completely different. Even if his goal at the outset wasn't to receive praise, soon enough he would have discovered the joy of learning and the pleasure of accomplishment himself. And I'm sure he'll finish school and head out into the world on his own two feet. So that leads to what Adler calls self-reliance.
Can you really say so for sure?
Please, acknowledge this. Whatever you may think, due to the praising, the students regained their smiles and their ambition. This is an education I am giving with all the heat of my body and soul to flesh and blood human beings living in the real world. In Adler's education, what warmth is there? What smiling faces?
Well, let's think about this together. Why do we stick to the principle of one must not praise in the education setting? There are children who enjoy and benefit from being praised, so why must one not praise? What are you risking by engaging in praise?
I wonder what quibble you're coming up with next. Look, I'm not going to make any concessions here. If you're going to revise your arguments, now is the time.
Reward gives rise to competition.
Earlier, I brought up the subject of the classroom being a democratic nation. Do you remember?
When you started calling people fascists? How could I forget?
Then I made the point that an organization that is under the command of a dictator cannot escape corruption. When we think a little more deeply about why this is so, the reason one must not praise should become clear as well.
Do tell.
In a community that has a dictatorship in place instead of an established democracy, all rules regarding what is right and what is wrong are determined at the sole discretion of the leader. This is the case for nations, of course, and corporate entities as well. And it is the same with families and schools. The rules in such communities are applied in a quite arbitrary manner.
Ah. Companies with top-down management and such are the epitome of that.
Now, though one might think that dictatorial leaders are despised by their citizens, this is not always the case. Actually, there are probably more instances in which they enjoy their citizens' ardent support. Why do you think this is so?
Because the leader has some charismatic appeal?
No, that is not why. That is only a secondary, superficial reason. The main reason is the presence of a cutthroat system of reward and punishment.
Huh. How so?
One is severely punished for breaking rules and praised for obeying them. And one is recognized. In other words, the people are not actually obeying out of support for the leader's character or his thoughts and beliefs, but simply because they have the goal of being praised or not being rebuked.
Well, sure, that's just how the world is.
Now, here is the problem. In that community where people gather with the goal of being praised, competition emerges. One finds it vexing when others are praised, and one is proud of being praised oneself. One is always concerned with how to be praised first, and more frequently than everyone else, and, beyond that, with how to have a monopoly on the leader's favor. In this way, the community comes to be controlled by a principle of competition for reward.
You're just beating around the bush. So, you don't like competition, is that it?
Do you accept competition?
I accept it wholeheartedly. It seems to me that you are focusing on only the negative aspects of competition. Think of it more broadly. Whether it's in our schoolwork, in our arts and sports events, or in our economic activities once we enter society, it is due to the presence of our rivals keeping up the pace beside us that we continue to step up our efforts. The principle of competition lies at the very root of the power that pushes our society forward.
Is that so? When children are placed within the principle of competition and driven to contend with others, what do you think happens? One's competitor is one's enemy. Before long, the children start to adopt a lifestyle in which they believe that all other people are my enemies, and people are always looking for chances to trick me and must never be underestimated.
Why do you think so pessimistically? You have no idea the degree to which the existence of a rival acts as a stimulus for human growth, nor the degree to which a rival can be a close friend one can rely on. I guess you've spent all your days absorbed in philosophy and lived a lonely life without close friends or rivals. I'm starting to feel pity for you.
I accept wholeheartedly the value of having a sworn friend whom one may call a rival. However, there is no need whatsoever for one to compete with that rival, and one must not compete with him.
You accept rivals, but not competition? Oh my, you're contradicting yourself already.
The disease of the community.
There is no contradiction or anything of the sort. Try to think of life as a kind of marathon. There are rivals running beside you. As this itself may act as a stimulus and feel reassuring, it does not present any problems. However, the moment one intends to defeat that rival, the situation changes completely. The goal at the outset, which should have been completing the race or running fast, transforms into the goal of defeating that person. The rival who should have been one's sworn friend turns into an enemy who must be crushed, and this brings out all manner of gamesmanship with regard to winning, and even results in interference and unfair conduct. Even after the race is over, one is unable to celebrate the victory of one's rival, and one struggles with feelings of envy and inferiority.
And that's why competition is unacceptable?
Wherever there is competition, gamesmanship, and unfairness arise. There is no need to defeat someone. If one can complete the race, isn't that enough?
No way! You're naive if you have notions like that.
Then let's stop using this marathon example and get back to real society. Unlike a marathon in which people vie for the best time, in a community run by a dictatorial leader, there are no clear criteria for winning. In a classroom, there are aspects besides schoolwork that can inform one's decisions. And as long as the judgment criteria are unclear, the world will be rampant with people who hold their comrades back, take credit for other people's work, and flatter their leaders so as to gain recognition only for themselves. You've witnessed this kind of thing even in your workplace, haven't you?
I guess so.
In order to prevent such situations from arising, an organization must implement a real democracy that is without reward and punishment and without competition. Please consider that educating by trying to manipulate people with reward and punishment is an attitude that could not be any further removed from democracy.
Then tell me this. What do you think democracy is? What kind of organization or community would you call democratic?
A community that is run not on the basis of the principle of competition, but on the principle of cooperation.
The principle of cooperation?
Put cooperation with others above all else instead of competition with others. If you can learn to run your classroom according to the principle of cooperation, your students are likely to adopt a lifestyle in which they see that people are my comrades.
Let's all get along and do our best. That sort of pipe dream doesn't hold water even in kindergartens today.
Suppose there is a student who is engaged repeatedly in problem behavior. Many educators would think to themselves, what should I do about this student? They would think about whether they should praise, rebuke, or ignore them, or if they should take some other approach. And then the student would be summoned to the teacher's room to be dealt with individually. But this way of thinking is wrong.
How so?
The problem here is the principle of competition pervading the entire classroom, not that the student got involved in problem behavior because they were bad. If they had pneumonia, for example, it would not be that they are suffering from pneumonia as an individual, but that the entire classroom had a serious case of it from the outset. His problem behavior has appeared as one symptom of that. This is the way of thinking of Adlerian psychology.
A sickness of the entire classroom?
Yes, it is a disease called the principle of competition. What is needed of educators is to look at the community in which the problem behavior is occurring, not at the individual who is engaging in it. And then, instead of attempting to treat the individual, to go about treating the community itself.
How does one treat an entire classroom that has pneumonia?
One stops engaging in reward and punishment and continually nips competition in the bud. One rids the classroom of the principle of competition. That is the only way.
That would be impossible and have the opposite effect. Have you forgotten that I've already tried no praising education and failed?
Yes, I know. At this point, let's step back for a moment and take stock of our discussion points. First of all, the strength and rank-contesting principle of competition always results in vertical relationships. Because it creates winners and losers and the hierarchical relationships that exist between them.
Okay.
The horizontal relationships advocated by Adlerian psychology, on the other hand, are imbued with the principle of cooperation. One does not compete with anyone, and there is no winning or losing. It does not matter if there are differences in knowledge, experience, or ability between oneself and others. All people are equal, regardless of scholastic achievement or work performance, and it is in the very act of cooperating with others that building community has meaning.
So, this is what you are talking about when you refer to a democratic nation?
Yes, Adlerian psychology is a horizontal, relationship-based psychology of democracy.
Life begins from incompleteness.
All right. The points of conflict are clear. You are saying that it is not a problem of the individual, but of the whole classroom. That the principle of competition permeating the classroom is the root of all evil. I, on the other hand, focus on the individual. Why is that? Well, to borrow your words, it's respect. Each and every student with their unique personality exists as a splendid human being. There are all kinds of students, some quiet and well-behaved, some noisy and bright, some serious, and some with fiery temperaments. They are not a gathering without individual traits.
Of course, that's true.
But you, even as you talk about democracy, are trying not to look at each of the children individually, and instead view them only as a group. Moreover, you are preaching, everything will change if we change the system. That's more communist than anything else. My view is different. It doesn't matter to me what the system is, democratic or communist or whatever. I deal with the pneumonia of each individual, not the pneumonia of the entire classroom.
Because that is what you have always done.
So, concretely speaking, how do you treat their pneumonia? This is another point of conflict. My answer is with approval, by fulfilling their need for approval. I get it. I really get your denial of the need for approval, but I actively accept it. This conclusion is one I have arrived at based on first-hand experience, so it's not something I will concede easily. In their search for approval, these children are sick in the lungs and numb with cold.
Could you explain the reasoning behind your conclusion?
In Adlerian psychology, you deny the need for approval. Why is that? It is because, as a result of their hopes of being accepted by another, a person, under the sway of the need for approval, will, before they know it, be living a life that conforms to that other person's wishes. In other words, they will be living another person's life. But a person does not live to fulfill someone else's expectations. Whether that person is one's parent, or one's teacher, or someone else, one must not choose a way of living that fulfills that person's expectations. Do I have it right?
Yes.
Being constantly concerned about how one is judged by others, one can no longer live one's own life. It becomes a way of living that is no longer free. We have to be free. And if one hopes to find freedom, one must not seek approval. This understanding is not mistaken, is it?
No, it is not mistaken.
It's a wonderful, truly courageous story, but, you know, we can't be tough enough, unfortunately. Even you, if you were to observe the real everyday situation with the students, you'd understand. They put everything they've got into acting tough, but inside, they're terribly insecure. They just don't seem to be able to get any confidence in themselves, and they suffer feelings of inferiority. They need approval from other people.
It's exactly as you say.
Don't agree so flippantly, you outdated Socrates. Look, the kind of people you're talking about are all just David statues.
David statues?
Yes. You know Michelangelo's statue of David, right? It's the ideal representation of the human body. All perfectly proportioned and muscular, without an ounce of flab to be found. But it's a supreme ideal image that is devoid of flesh and blood, not a human being that exists in reality. Real, live people get stomach aches and bleed. You're always talking about people as if they're that Statue of David ideal.
That's an interesting way of putting it.
What I am focusing on, however, is actual living people. I'm talking about sensitive, highly individualistic children who are awkward and thin-skinned in every way. I have to fulfill that need for approval for each one of them individually, and in a healthier manner. In a word, I have to praise them. If I don't, they won't be able to regain the courage they've lost. You wear the mask of a man of virtue, but you keep the weak at arm's length. You've got idealistic theories of the heroic and the lion-hearted, but nothing for real people.
I see. Though my words may have sounded like impractical, idealistic theories, that was not my intention. Philosophy must be an inquiry that is firmly grounded with the awareness that the ideals we pursue are ideals. Let us take another angle to consider the reasons that Adlerian psychology does not accept the need for approval.
Trying to justify everything, just like Socrates.
The phrase you just brought up, feelings of inferiority, is key.
You want to talk about feelings of inferiority? Okay, I'm an expert on feelings of inferiority, you know.
First of all, during childhood, all humans, without exception, live with feelings of inferiority. This is a major premise of Adlerian psychology.
Without exception?
That's right. The human being is probably the only living thing with a body that takes longer to grow than the mind. While with other creatures, mind and body develop at the same speed, only in humans does development of the mind happen first, while that of the body lags behind. In a sense, we are creatures who live bound hand and foot, because though our minds are free, our bodies are not.
That's an interesting viewpoint.
As a result, human children have to struggle with the gap between the what I want to do mental aspects and the what I can do physical aspects. There are things that the adults around them can do, but they cannot. That shelf where the adults put things is out of reach to them. Those stones the adults can carry, they cannot. And the subjects of their conversations are not things children can talk about. Children experience this sense of powerlessness, or one might say incompleteness of self, and as a rule, cannot help but have feelings of inferiority.
So they start their lives as incomplete beings?
Yes. Of course, children are not incomplete as people. It is only that the growth of their bodies has not caught up with that of their minds. But then the adults look only at their physical needs and start to baby them. They do not try to look at the children's minds, so it is only natural that the children suffer feelings of inferiority. Because even though their minds are no different from the adults' minds, their human worth is not being recognized.
All people start out as incomplete beings, so everyone experiences feelings of inferiority. That's a pretty pessimistic point of view.
It is not all bad. This feeling of inferiority, rather than being a handicap, has always been a stimulant of effort and growth.
How so?
If human legs were as fast as horses, the horse-drawn carriage would never have been invented, and probably not the motor vehicle either. If we could fly like birds, the airplane would never have been invented. If we had fur like a polar bear, winter clothing would never have been invented, and if we could swim like dolphins, there would never have been a need for boats or marine compasses. Civilization is a product of the need to compensate for the biological weakness of the human being, and the history of the human race is the history of its triumphing over its inferiority.
It's because we humans were weak that we were able to build up such a civilization?
That's right. And to extrapolate further, it is due to that weakness that humans create communities and live in relationships of cooperation. Ever since the hunter-gatherer age, we have lived in groups and cooperated with our comrades in hunting animals and raising children. It isn't that we wanted to cooperate with each other. It is that we were weak, so desperately weak, that we could not live separately.
It is due to that weakness that humans formed groups and built society. So our power and our civilization are the fruits of our weakness.
Put the other way around, nothing is scarier to humans than isolation. Isolated people have not only their physical security threatened, but their mental security as well. Because instinctively, we are well aware that we cannot live alone. As a consequence, we are always longing for a strong connection with other people. Do you understand what this fact means?
No. What does it mean?
All people have community feeling inside them inherently, and it is something that is deeply linked to human identity.
Oh!
Just as one would not imagine a turtle without its shell, or a giraffe with a short neck, there is no such thing as a human being who is completely cut off from other people. Community feeling is not something that is attained, but something that one digs up from within oneself, which is why it can be shared as a feeling. As Adler elucidates, community feeling is always a reflection of the weakness of the body, and one from which we cannot be separated.
A community feeling resulting from human weakness.
Human beings are physically weak, but the human mind is second to none, much stronger than that of any other animal. I am sure you know well enough the degree to which spending one's days in competition with one's comrades is against the principles of nature. Community feeling is not some head-in-the-clouds ideal. It is a fundamental principle of life that resides within us humans.
community feeling. That key concept of Adlerian psychology, which he had struggled so long to grasp and whose inner truth had been unfathomable, was now as clear as day to him. It is because of their physical weakness that humans create community and live in relationships of cooperation. Human beings always seek connection with other human beings. Community feeling exists inherently in everyone's minds. The philosopher was saying, "Dig up your own community feeling and seek connection with other people." With difficulty, the youth ventured a question. The courage to be myself.
But why is the existence of that feeling of inferiority and that community feeling linked to not accepting the need for approval? Approving each other should actually strengthen the connection.
Well, at this point, it would behoove you to recall the 5 stages of problem behavior.
Right. I have them written down here in my notebook.
What is the goal of the students running about with their demand for admiration and their launching into attention drawing and power struggles? Do you remember?
They want to be recognized, and they want to gain a special position within the classroom. That's right, isn't it?
Yes. Now, what is gaining a special position? Why do they seek to do that? What is your view on this?
I suppose it's because they want to be respected, to be viewed as superior, and that sort of thing.
Strictly speaking, no. In Adlerian psychology, a human being's most fundamental need is the sense of belonging. In a word, we do not want to be isolated. We want to have the real feeling that it's okay to be here. Because isolation leads to social death and eventually even to biological death. Now, how can they gain a sense of belonging? By gaining a special position within the community, by not becoming everyone else.
By not becoming everyone else?
That's right. Their irreplaceable this me must not become everyone else. They must secure a place to be that can be all their own at any time. They must not allow any wavering in their sense of belonging that it's okay to be here.
If that's the case, it proves my point even more. By praising them and fulfilling their earnest need for approval, one conveys to them, you are not an incomplete being, and you have worth. There's no other way.
You are wrong. Unfortunately, if they proceed in that direction, they will not be able to realize their true worth.
Why is that?
There is no end to approval, so they get praised and approved by others. As a result, they might find some fleeting realization of their own worth. Any joyful feeling thus gained, however, will be nothing more than something granted from outside them. They will be no different from clockwork dolls that do not move unless another person winds them up.
Maybe so, but...
The person who is capable of feeling truly happy only upon being praised will seek to get praised more until the very last moment of their life. Such a person, having been left in a position of dependence, will lead a life of ceaseless seeking, a life without fulfillment.
Then what should one do?
Instead of seeking approval, one has to approve oneself with one's own mind.
Approve oneself?
Having another person decide the worth of me, that is dependence. Determining the worth of me, oneself, that is self-reliance. If one were to ask which choice leads to a happy life, the answer should be clear. Your worth is not decided by someone else.
That's impossible. We don't have confidence in ourselves, and that's exactly why we need approval from others.
That is probably because we don't have enough courage to be normal. It's okay to be just as we are. Your place to be is there, without needing to be a special being or be outstanding in any way. Let's accept our ordinary selves, ourselves, as everyone else.
I am an ordinary everyone else without any outstanding qualities?
Aren't you?
Making such insults comes perfectly naturally to you, doesn't it? That is the greatest insult I've ever received in my life.
It is not an insult. I am a normal person, and being normal is an aspect of individuality. It is nothing to be ashamed about.
Enough of your wisecracking, you sadist. What person today would not take being told you are a common, ordinary human being as an insult? What person would be comforted by hearing that's individuality too, and take you seriously?
If you feel insulted by these words, you are probably still trying to be a special me. Consequently, you seek approval from others, and therefore you seek to gain admiration and draw attention and continue to live within the framework of problem behavior.
Stop it! Stop messing around!
Look, instead of placing worth on being different from other people, place worth on being yourself. That is true individuality. A way of living in which, instead of being yourself, you compare yourself to others and try to accentuate only your difference is just a way of living in which you deceive both others and yourself.
You're saying, rather than laying emphasis on my difference from others, place worth on being myself, even if that's mediocre?
Yes, because your individuality is not something relative, it is absolute.
Well, let's talk about the conclusion I have arrived at with regard to this individuality and such. It is a conclusion that would seem to indicate the limitations of school education.
I would like to hear about it.
That problem behavior is directed at you.
I have been uncertain all along whether I should say this or not. But here we are. It's time to come clean. Somewhere inside me, I am feeling that school education has limitations.
Limitations?
That's right. For us educators, there is a limit to what can be done.
What do you mean?
In the classroom, there are bright and extroverted students, and there are modest, inconspicuous students, too. To use Adler's terminology, everyone has their particular lifestyle or worldview. No one is the same. That's individuality, right?
Yes.
Then where do they get those lifestyles from? Without question, it is from their families.
Indeed, the influence of the family is quite strong.
The students spend the better part of each day at home, and they share everyday life itself with their families in impossibly close quarters under a single roof. Some parents are passionate about education, and some are passive when it comes to child rearing. Many households have divorced or separated parents, or have lost a parent. There are differences in economic status, of course, and there are also parents who abuse their children.
Yes, unfortunately there are.
On the other side of things, the period of time that we teachers can commit to each student is the scant few years until they graduate. Compared to the parents, who can give almost a lifetime of commitment, the preconditions differ too greatly.
And what do you conclude from that?
First of all, the kind of broadly defined education that would include personality formation is the responsibility of the family. In other words, in the case of a violent problem child, it is the parents who must assume the unequivocal responsibility of having raised such a child. There can be no mistaking this to be the responsibility of the school. Therefore, the role that is expected of us teachers is one of narrowly defined education. That is to say, education on the level of curriculum. We cannot get any more involved than that. I feel quite ashamed about this conclusion, but it is the reality.
I see. Adler would probably reject this conclusion out of hand.
Why? How?
Because it must be said, the conclusion you have drawn disregards the personalities of the children.
It disregards their personalities?
In Adlerian psychology, we regard all manner of human words and actions in terms of interpersonal relationships. For example, when we have a person who has been engaging in wrist-cutting or other self-harm, we do not regard that conduct as being directed at nothing at all. The act of self-harm is directed at someone, just as we saw with the revenge problem behavior. In other words, we think that for all words and actions, there is another party at whom they are directed.
And then?
How do the students in your charge behave within their families, on the other hand? This is something that we cannot know. It is doubtful that they have exactly the same face that they do at school, however, because whether it's the face they show their parents, the face they show their teachers, the face they show their friends, or the face they show their junior and senior schoolmates, no one wears the same face all the time.
Well, maybe so.
And now there is a student in your classroom who is repeatedly engaging in problem behaviour. At whom is that problem behaviour directed? At you, of course.
What?
When that student puts on the mask of the face they show you, they are repeatedly engaging in problem behaviour directed at you and no one else. It is not the parents' problem. It is a problem that has arisen entirely within the relationship between you and the student.
Are you saying that their education at home doesn't matter?
We cannot know about that, and we cannot intervene. Regardless, right now, they are facing you and resolving something to the effect of, I'm going to disrupt this teacher's class, or I'll disregard the homework this teacher assigns me. Of course, there are cases in which the student is continuing to engage in problem behavior at school and, at the same time, resolving, I'll be a good child in front of my parents. As this is behavior that is directed at you, you have to take it in, first of all.
It's a task that I have to solve in my class?
You've got it, exactly, because they are seeking help from you and no one else.
Those kids keep on engaging in problem behavior directed only at me.
Moreover, they're doing it right in front of you, and choosing times when it will be within your field of vision. They are looking for a place to be in another world that is not their home, that is to say, in your classroom. Through respect, you have to show them that place to be.
Why a person wants to become a savior.
Adler is utterly terrifying. If I hadn't learned about Adler, I wouldn't need to be struggling like this. I would have guided my students without a doubt in my head, yelling at the ones who should be rebuked and issuing high praise to the ones who should be praised, just as the other teachers do. The students would have been grateful to me, and I would have been able to fulfill the role of teaching as my vocation. More than ever, I wish I had never heard about all these ideals.
It is true that once one learns of Adler's way of thinking, there is no turning back. There are many people who have been exposed to Adler who, just like you, try to brush it off by saying, that's an idealistic theory, or it's unscientific. And yet, they can't give up on it. Somewhere inside them, there is a feeling of incongruity that remains. They cannot help but be aware of their lie. Truly, one might call it a strong medicine of life.
Let's sort out the points of discussion up until now. First of all, one must not rebuke children, because rebuking is conduct that damages each other's respect, and anger and reprimand are low-cost, immature, and violent means of communication. Do I have it right?
Yes.
And again, one must not praise either. Praising gives rise to the principle of competition within the community and implants in the child a lifestyle or worldview of other people are my enemies.
That's right.
Furthermore, rebuking and praising, in other words, reward and punishment, stand in the way of the child's self-reliance, because reward and punishment are a conduct of trying to keep the child under one's control. And the adult who relies on this conduct is, somewhere deep inside, afraid of the child's self-reliance.
They want the child to stay a child forever. Consequently, they use that reward and punishment to restrain children. Prepared with such excuses as, I'm doing it for you, or it's because I'm worried about you, they try to make the child stay a child. This sort of attitude in adults contains no respect whatsoever and cannot lead to the building of good relationships.
That's not all. Adler denies even the need for approval. He says that we should not seek approval from others, but instead switch to approval of ourselves.
Yes, this is a problem that should be considered within the context of self-reliance.
I know. Self-reliance is one's own determining of one's worth. The attitude of the need for approval, of trying to get another person to decide one's worth, is just dependence. That is what you're saying, right?
Yes. Some people, on hearing the term self-reliance, will only be able to consider its economic aspects. But there are 10-year-old children who are self-reliant, and there are people in their 50s and 60s who are not. Self-reliance is a matter of the psyche.
All right. It certainly is a wonderful logic. As a philosophy presented here in this study, at least, it is completely beyond reproach.
But you are not satisfied with this philosophy.
You're right. I'm not. If it stops at philosophy and cannot be brought down to a practical, scientific level that will hold water outside the walls of this study, and in my classroom in particular, then I won't be able to agree with it. You are the one who got me into Adler. Of course, making the final decision is my job. But if you're only going to lay out the prohibitions, one must not do this and one must not do that, and so on, without indicating some other choice, I'll be at a loss for what to do. As things stand, I can't go back to reward and punishment education, and I'm not ready to put complete faith in Adler's education either.
The answer is probably a simple one.
Sure. Maybe it's simple for you. Because all you can say is, believe in Adler, choose Adler.
No, whether or not you give up on Adler doesn't matter at this point. The most important thing to do now is to move away from the subject of education for the time being.
Move away from education?
I'm telling you this as a friend. You have been talking about education all day long, but that is not where your real troubles lie. You have not learned to be happy yet. You are not able to have the courage to be happy. And you did not choose the path of the educator because you wanted to save children. You wanted to be saved through the act of saving them.
What did you say?
By saving another person, one tries to be saved oneself. By passing oneself off as a kind of savior, one attempts to realize one's own worth. This is one form of the superiority complex that people who cannot dispel their feelings of inferiority often fall into, and is generally referred to as a messiah complex. It is a mental perversion of wanting to be a messiah, a savior of others.
Don't mess around! What are you suggesting all of a sudden?
Raising one's voice in anger in such a way is also an expression of feelings of inferiority. When one's feelings of inferiority are aroused, one tries to resolve them by using the emotion of anger.
Ah, you!
The important thing is what we will get into next. Salvation by a person who is unhappy does not overcome self-satisfaction and does not make anyone happy. While you set about saving children, you are actually still in the midst of unhappiness yourself. You are hoping only to realize your own worth. And if that is the case, there's no point in bouncing around more education theory. Find happiness on your own, first of all. Otherwise, any discussion we engage in here is likely to end in a fruitless exchange of invective.
Fruitless? This discussion will be fruitless?
If you are going to choose to not change things as they are, I will respect that decision. It is fine to return to school just as you are now. But if you are going to choose to change, then today is the only day to do so. This is something that goes beyond work or education and is about questioning your life itself.
Move away from the discussion of education. You don't want to save the children. You're just stuck in a vortex of unhappiness and want to save yourself through education. To the youth, these words amounted to a letter of recommendation to resign that negated his entire being as an educator.
I had my eyes open to Adler's shining light and set my heart on the path of education in the face of all manner of hardship, and this is the treatment that was waiting for me?
And then, a thought occurred to him.
I wonder if this is how the people of Athens felt when they informed Socrates that he was sentenced to death. This man is too dangerous. If he's left to his own nefarious devices, the poison of his nihilism will spread across the world.
Education is friendship, not work.
Ah, you've got to be thankful for my self-control. If it were 10 or even 5 years ago, I wouldn't have had the self-control for this, and I probably would have smashed my fist into your nose by now.
Well, that wouldn't be good, but I see your point. Adler himself experienced violence from his clients on occasion.
I'll bet he did. It's just rewards for pushing such extreme views.
One of Adler's patients for a time was a girl who suffered from severe mental illness. This was a girl who had been struggling with symptoms for 8 years already, and 2 years prior to their meeting, it had been deemed necessary to commit her to an institution. Of their first encounter, Adler states, she barked like a dog, spat, tore at her clothes, and tried to eat her handkerchief.
That is beyond the scope of counseling.
Yes, her symptoms were so serious that her doctor had given up on her case. So the doctor reached out to Adler to see if he couldn't do anything to help her.
And did he?
He did. In the end, she recovered completely and managed to return to society, earn her own living, and live in harmony with those around her. As Adler relates, no one who sees her now would believe that she had ever suffered from insanity.
What sort of magic did he use?
There is no magic to Adlerian psychology. Adler only spoke to her. He spoke to her for 8 days in a row, but she did not utter a word. He continued her counseling, and after 30 days she began to talk in a confused and unintelligible way. Adler understood the reason why she behaved like a dog to be as follows. She felt that she had been treated like a dog by her mother. He did not know whether or not she really had been treated that way, but at the very least she did feel that way. And as an act of rebellion against her mother, she had resolved subconsciously to really play the role of dog.
As a kind of self-harm, as it were?
Exactly. It was self-harm. Her dignity as a human being had been hurt, and she was keeping the wound open with her own hands. That is why Adler was speaking to her patiently as an equal human being.
I see.
Now, after he had continued her counseling in this way for some time, one day she began hitting him all of a sudden. What did Adler do then? He put up no resistance whatsoever and allowed her to hit him. When, carried away by the impulse, the girl then broke a window and cut her hand on the glass, Adler quietly bandaged the wound.
Huh. It's like an episode straight out of the Bible, isn't it? You're trying to make Adler out to be some kind of a saint. Sorry, but I'm not so easily fooled.
Adler was not a saint, of course, and neither was he choosing the path of non-resistance from a moral viewpoint in this case.
Then why didn't he put up any resistance?
Adler explains that when the girl first began to speak, he had the feeling, "I am her friend." And when she began attacking him for no reason, he simply let her hit me and looked friendly. In other words, Adler did not interact with the girl as part of his job or his profession, but as a friend. Say a friend of yours, who has been mentally ill for a long time, suddenly became confused and started hitting you. If you can imagine such a scene, then maybe you can see that Adler's actions were not in any way out of the ordinary.
Well, I can understand if the person is truly a friend.
Now, there is something we need to recall again at this point. The statement, counseling is re-education for self-reliance, and the counselor is an educator. And further, the definition, the educator is a counselor. Adler, who was both a counselor and an educator, would interact with each client as a friend. So you too should interact with each of your students as a friend, because you too are an educator and a counselor.
Huh?
The reason you have failed at Adlerian-style teaching and are still unable to find real happiness is a simple one. It is that you have been avoiding the three life tasks of work, friendship, and love.
The life tasks?
You're trying to face your students is work now. But as Adler shows from his own experience, your relationship with the students is one of friendship. You started off on the wrong foot, and if you don't do something about it, there's no way your teaching is going to go over well.
You're talking nonsense. Behave like I'm a friend to those kids?
One does not behave as if that is so. One builds a relationship of friendship in the truest sense of the word.
You're wrong. I am proud to be a professional educator. It is precisely because I am a professional and that it's work for which I receive remuneration that I am able to bear the great responsibility.
I understand what you want to say, but my view remains the same. The relationship you should create with your students is one of friendship. 3 years ago, we did not manage to discuss the life tasks deeply enough. Once you understand the life tasks, I think you should be able to grasp the meaning of the phrase I began with today, the biggest choice in life, and the meaning of the courage to be happy as well.
And what if I'm not convinced?
Then you should just give up on Adler and give up on me too.
It's funny. You're really sure of yourself, aren't you?
Part 4. Give, and it shall be given unto you. There was no clock in the philosopher's study. How long had they been engaged in this discussion? How many more hours were left until daybreak? Even as he reproached himself for having forgotten his watch, the youth ruminated over the content of their discussion until now.
A messiah complex? Build a friendship relationship with my students? This is no joke. You say that I misunderstand Adler, but you misunderstand me. And you're the one who's avoiding your life tasks and avoiding contact with other people by shutting yourself up in this study of yours.
All joy is interpersonal relationship joy.
I am in the midst of unhappiness now. I am troubled not about school education, but only about my own life. And the reason for that is that I am avoiding my life tasks. That's what you're telling me, right?
If you are going to sum it up in a few words, yes.
Moreover, you are saying that instead of facing my students as my work, I need to build friendship relationships with them. Because, in other words, that's what Adler did. Adler faced his clients as friends. That Adler did it, so I should do the same. Do you think I could find such a reason convincing?
If my stance were that you should do something simply because Adler did, I very much doubt you would find it convincing. The basis for my argument lies elsewhere entirely.
If you don't reveal what that is, it will be nothing more than pretext.
All right. Adler called the tasks an individual must confront in order to live in society the life tasks.
I know. The task of work, the task of friendship, and the task of love, right?
Yes. The important point here is that these tasks are interpersonal relationships. In a work task situation, for example, rather than treating one's labor itself as the task, one focuses on the interpersonal relationships that are associated with it. In that sense, it may be easier to understand the tasks by thinking of them as work relationships, friend relationships, and love relationships.
So, in other words, focus on the relationships, not on the actions.
Right. Now, why does Adler focus on interpersonal relationships? This is an aspect that lies at the very core of Adlerian psychology. Do you know the answer?
I suppose it's his premise that all problems are interpersonal relationship problems. That is to say, his definition of suffering.
That's right. But this definition itself requires some explanation. In the first place, what reason could he have to assert that all problems are interpersonal relationship problems? Adler says...
Get to the point. I'll explain it succinctly, so we'll be done with it. All problems are interpersonal relationship problems. To get to the true meaning of this statement, you just consider the opposite. Supposing there were only one me existing in the universe, what would it be like? It would most likely be a world in which neither language nor logic existed. There would be no competition, no envy, and no loneliness either. because it is only with the existence of another person who shuns me that a human being can feel loneliness. Loneliness cannot arise if one is truly alone.
Yes, loneliness exists only within relationships.
But the fact is that such a hypothesis is impossible, because in principle, there is no way that we can live separated from other people. Every person is born from a mother's womb and raised on her milk. We are born in a condition of not being able to turn over in our own bed, let alone feed ourselves. And then, the moment when we as babies open our eyes and confirm the existence of another person, in most cases that would be the mother, society comes into being. With the appearance of the father, siblings, and others from outside the family, society becomes increasingly complex.
Yes.
The birth of society is, in other words, the birth of suffering. In society, we are exposed to all manner of suffering, such as conflict, competition, envy, and loneliness, not to mention feelings of inferiority. Between me and that person, there is a resounding dissonance. Never again can we return to those days of tranquility, when we were enveloped in warm amniotic fluid. We have no choice but to live in the incessant hubbub of human society. If other people did not exist, no problems would exist either. But there is absolutely no way that we can escape the existence of other people. Therefore, all the problems that people have are interpersonal relationship problems. Is there anything incorrect in this understanding?
No, you have done an excellent job of summing things up, but allow me to add one point. If all problems stem from interpersonal relationships, is it all right to just sever one's relations with other people? Is it all right to just stay away from other people and shut oneself up in one's room? No, it is not all right. It is not all right at all. The reason it is not is that all the joy of humanity comes from interpersonal relationships too. A person living all alone in the universe would have to lead a life that is utterly flat and featureless, with neither problems nor joy. Concealed beneath a statement put forth by Adler, all problems are interpersonal relationship problems, there lies this definition of happiness. All joy is interpersonal relationship joy.
Which is precisely why we must confront our life tasks.
Yes, it is.
All right, now, about that question. Why do I have to build friendship relationships with my students?
Right. What is friendship in the first place? Why are we assigned the task of friendship? Let's use Adler's words as our guide. Adler makes the following statement with regard to friendship. In friendship, we see with the eyes of another, listen with the ears of another, and feel with the heart of another.
That's what you mentioned earlier as...
Yes, it is the definition of community feeling.
What are you saying? That we learn human knowledge and gain community feeling through friendship relationships?
No, the word gain is incorrect. Earlier, I spoke of community feeling as a feeling that resides within all people. It is not something one strives to gain, but something one digs up from within oneself. So, to be precise, it is a feeling that we dig up through friendship. It is in our friendship relationships that our contribution to others is tested. A person who does not embark on friendship can never hope to find a place to be within the community.
Hold on a minute.
No, I will continue until the conclusion. The point of concern here is this. Where does one put friendship into practice? I'm sure you already know the answer, the place where children first learn friendship and begin to dig up community feeling. That place is school.
Hey, hold on, I said. You're developing things too fast and I don't get what's what anymore. If school is the place where children learn friendship, I should become their friend?
This is a point that is misunderstood by many people. The relationship of friendship is not something limited to the relationship between friends. Friendship relationships are often formed even when relations are not such that one would call the other person a friend. So, what is this thing that Adler speaks of as friendship? Why does it connect to community feeling? Let's go into this in depth.